Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, I'm Catherine May and welcome to the Wintering Sessions. Each week I talk to a different writer about the cold seasons in their life and how they survived. Today I'm delighted to introduce you to Ginny Reddy, author of Wonderland, A Search for Magic in the Landscape. Hi Ginny.
Hi Catherine.
It's lovely to meet you. I've been chatting to you on Twitter for a long, long time and it's so lovely to hear your voice.
Well, it's lovely to hear your voice too, and I'm really looking forward to the theme today.
Yes, that wintry theme. And actually, I was just reading your biog on the flap of your lovely book, and it just struck me what an incredible citizen of the world you are. Can I just read that biog, because it's more like a travelogue than a life history. It says she was born in London to Indian parents who grew up in apartheid era South Africa, was raised in Montreal. You studied geography, which it sounds to me like you didn't need to because you kind of are geography. And then it sounds like you travelled all over the world. How does that influence you, just knowing all those different places?
I think it gifts me with many pairs of eyes and the ability to see things from the perspective of the other.
Yeah, it sounds to me so impressively cosmopolitan. I've always lived in England. I feel very disappointing on this front, but it must give you incredible perspective on the world as a whole rather than just your small corner of it.
Yeah, I think when an issue arises, I'm always considering or trying to consider or be mindful of the global perspective. Remember that the way something looks to us is not necessarily how it looks to somebody else on the other side of the world.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're just in the middle of the big Black Lives Matter protests and all of the news that's rolling out from that, and I think hopefully more of us are beginning to learn to realize that perspective is very unique to us. Maybe we're not, who knows, perhaps that's optimistic. So you're going to talk to us today about a wintering period in your life that you write about in Wonderland, which you call the misery years. That's quite the period of time, isn't it?
Yes, I just want to clarify that I call those the misery years, but that's not what I call it in the book.
Oh, yes, sorry.
In the book, the chapter is called Walking Through Woods in Pain.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, sorry. But then you go on in the paragraph to say that you tend to refer to it as the misery years. And that really struck me, because to have a phase in your life that you identify that strongly with is quite devastating. So it starts off with you temping, which sounds like it wasn't much fun for you.
So I'd been traveling abroad and I ran out of money, and I ended up working in Hong Kong for 2 years. And then I left Hong Kong, and I left because I lost my, I didn't lose my job. I left my job, couldn't find another job. And my boyfriend dumped me and broke my heart.
Oh, no.
Basically. So then I came back to London and tried to find a job and was really unsuccessful. And so I ended up temping. And I don't know if you've ever temped, Catherine, but I really
have. It's hideous. It's absolutely hideous.
And I was a terrible temp. I just didn't like taking orders, basically. I didn't like not to do things. So there were times when somebody would ask me to do something, and I would say I was going to the loo, and I just run down the fire escape and then just keep running and never go back.
And who could blame you? My abiding memory of temping was that in the window of the temping office, there'd always be these really highly paid jobs that paid, you know, 15 quid an hour or something. And you'd gaze outside and you think, yeah, I'd really like to earn 15 quid an hour. And you'd go in and everything would be £8.50 an hour. You know, it was really, they really oversold it. It was really, and it was always really grim, menial kind of work.
Oh, yeah. And I always found it really painful going into a new office and being like the least valued person in the room.
Yes, absolutely.
Particularly as I'd had a really good job beforehand, right, before leaving. I'd worked in book publishing. And I'd had, you know, in London, I'd had it before I'd gone off to travel. I'd had a job I really enjoyed. So it really felt like I'd come down in the world.
Yeah, it's a very, very dead end feeling. So when you weren't escaping down fire escapes, you were making other plans to escape, and you ended up teaching English in Tbilisi.
That's right. So after the temping, and the temping went on for about a year, you know, really miserable year, I have to say.
It's long enough, isn't it?
Long enough. Even more than a year, maybe, you know, a year and a half, 2 years. And so I was getting desperate, and I decided to do a TEFL course, teaching English as a foreign language. And with my certificate, I applied to countries around the world, organizations around the world, and it was a school in Tbilisi that took me.
So that sounds like a very difficult environment to be, because you arrived in the aftermath of a civil war, is that right?
Yes, that's right. I arrived in the dead of winter and in the aftermath of a civil war, and it was really bleak.
Set the scene, go on.
Well, I remember arriving at the airport, and I think it must have been, you know, 4 a.m. or something, very odd time. And there were these, you know, armed officers, army people. It looked like something out of, you know, some Soviet era film. I remember this man held up a sign, and he took me into the car, and we drove for hours into the city. And I got taken to this hotel, and I remember walking down the corridor of this hotel, and there were these refugees, and they were in the hotel rooms, and they were burning fires in their hotel rooms.
Oh my goodness.
And I remember thinking, oh my god, you know, what have I come to? What's going on? You know, what's the situation? And then I was given an apartment to live in, and this apartment was incredible. It had 5 rooms and chandeliers, but no heating.
And so in the middle of winter.
Yeah, so I'd have to go down the street and try and communicate with this man who sold kerosene, and I'd have to sort of buy the kerosene and then carry it back. And the apartment that I lived in the block that I lived in, these were Soviet era blocks, and so they all looked identical. So often I'd go to the wrong one. And I'm not kidding, I really often did go to the wrong one, and I'd think, where am I? And then I had to lug this kerosene up to my apartment. And I think once I nearly set the bedroom on fire. it was wow. Pretty disastrous. The students were lovely, though.
Okay, so that was a kind of upside.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I loved teaching grammar, you know, or any of that.
But it's not the sexy part of English, that, is it?
It's not sexy, no. But the students were really warm and very curious. And I often felt like just doing away with the lesson and just saying, ask me any questions you have, fire away.
So, but it must have been quite scary on your own in that situation. I mean, you say in your book there were kind of bullet holes and things like that visible. And
oh yes, yeah, there was a lot of that. And you know, I was one of the few Asian people in the city, or you know, one of the few Indian people in the city. And you know, I did get stared at quite a bit, and that was disconcerting.
Yeah.
And I don't speak the language, and Georgians often don't speak English, or they didn't, or the ones I met didn't. And the alphabet is nothing like our alphabet. So I couldn't really make out anything, you know, the street signs or anything. I'm sure it's changed a lot now, but then it was challenging.
So amid all of that, something really terrible happened back home.
Yeah, so while I was out there, my father died. And so I rushed back to London. And my mum was in the UK. She was in London. She and my father had moved over from Canada 6 months earlier. So they'd come back. They'd been living in Canada for years and years. They'd built a life there for themselves. And they returned to the UK because they wanted to be with their grandchildren, my sister's kids. And so they hadn't really had time to reestablish themselves in Britain because they'd lived in Britain before moving to Canada.
Right.
So I moved in with my mum. And so that was, you know, that was a bit of a change. And where my mum and I are very close, but it was still a big change for me.
And you're grieving for your father, and it sounds like you had nothing of your old life left, really.
Yeah, I was grieving for my father, and I had nothing of my old life left. Although I was ever so slightly relieved not to be teaching in Tbilisi.
It was an escape route, I suppose.
Strangely enough. And so, yeah, it was really difficult, and I had to go back and temp some more, which I hated. I felt like I was in this kind of just, you know, Sisyphus rolling the stone up the hill and then falling down again, and then trying to make things work and trying to apply for things and not getting the jobs and just wondering, you know, what was going to happen to me.
How old were you by then?
Well, I was in my early 30s.
It's such a difficult period of your life, that, isn't it? Because there are loads of people by that point of your age who are really well established and who are in, I'm going to say, proper jobs, you know, and you'll know what I mean. I mean, I think if you followed a creative career, you look at other people with proper career structures, you know, an HR department, you know, promotions, salaries, bonuses, pensions. And it can feel like you're treading water. It certainly did to me, I think.
Yeah, I felt that these were meant to be the best years of my life. And I was floundering.
Yeah.
And no matter what I tried, no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't change things. And that was really difficult, very difficult.
Life just kind of keeps happening to you, basically.
Yeah. And then I remember 2 years after my father died, and I woke up, and it was the first time I felt that equilibrium had been restored. And that day my sister died.
That's extraordinary. It's like life kind of knocking you back down again when you're just standing up.
Yeah. And she died of a heart attack.
Oh my goodness.
Like my father. Very, very suddenly. And you know, it's very difficult to talk about these things even now, because I it doesn't just affect me. It didn't just affect me, it affected her family too. But suffice it to say, it was a very distressing period.
Extraordinarily distressing when someone so young dies, and when, you know, when you've got multiple griefs happening at once, that can be incredibly complicated as well.
Yeah. And so I went off, and I think actually this was maybe before my sister died, but I went off to India when I was grieving for my father. I went off to India for 3 months, and I thought I was going to write a book. So I didn't really have any great reason to write this book, you know, no compelling story. I think what I was trying to do was come to terms with his death. And so anyway, so I wrote this book, and after my sister died, I tried to get it published, and nobody wanted the book.
Right. Which is such a common experience with your first book, isn't it?
It's a really common experience, but but I kind of felt, well, now what?
Yeah.
Don't know what else to do.
And was that, so was your ambition to be a writer at that point, or was it, was that just something you were kind of casting around for?
I'd wanted to be a writer from the time I was born.
Yeah.
There was never a time when I didn't want to write a book.
Right. Yeah. But the right one hadn't kind of landed in your head yet.
Yes. And I and you know, opportunities too. I wasn't always aware of how to make these things happen. I didn't necessarily know the right people. It's true, I'd worked in book publishing, but that had been some time earlier.
Yeah, it doesn't always tell you everything about it, I think, if you just work on the inside too. I meet quite a lot of people who work in publishing who want to write, and it always surprises me that they sometimes know less about how to produce a book than people who've just kind of, you know, read the odd blog about it. The information that circulates inside publishing houses feels very different, I think.
Yeah, I mean, my job, I loved my job. I wrote back jackets, blurbs.
Oh, fantastic.
And I got to read the books too. I didn't just skim the books. I was given the time to read the books.
Right.
So I just rock up and crack open a book and a sip coffee.
Lovely job.
That would be 2 days of the week. And then one day I'd write the blurb and then crack open another book. but I never, you know, never knew how one went about getting a book commissioned.
Yeah. I don't think anyone still does now, really. There never seems to be one fixed route to do it. It's always very, very kind of baffling and confusing. So with your father and your sister gone, how did you begin to recover from that? That's such a monumental loss to start to process.
Well, I think time, just a question of time. And at that point, you know, I was ready to try anything. Yeah. In terms of career. And I remember when he was alive, my father had always said to me, you know, why don't you try to become a journalist, because, you know, you like reading, you like writing. And I had always been very dismissive of journalism. And the thing is, I had actually had one piece published in the Times.
Wow, that's a fantastic start.
what had happened is, when I had been traveling before I had started working in Hong Kong, I'd been volunteering in India, in Calcutta, and I was very moved by the experience. So when I was temping and meant to be working, I'd be trying to write this article.
We've all done that while we're temping, don't worry. That's
and so I maybe wrote this article to be 30 times and sent it off to all the newspapers.
Right.
And the Times took it.
So tell me about your volunteering. I'm really fascinated by that. What were you doing when you were volunteering?
I was at Mother Teresa's.
As you do.
For 3 months. And, you know, there were way more volunteers than were needed. But for me, it was quite a transformative experience. I'd never been in a situation like that before. You know, growing up in Canada, I'd been accustomed to, you know, very middle class existence.
Sure.
And here, you know, the poverty was kind of in my face. And I've been to India and I've experienced India from a completely different perspective. You know, I've stayed in very nice heritage hotels and been around wealthy Indians too. So I'm not unaware of the Indian middle class or the wealth that there is in India. But this was a different side to India.
And,
it left a big impression on me.
It must have done. And so you come back with this incredible experience behind you and this incredible perspective on, I don't know. I've traveled in India and I just felt like you see all of human life somehow. It makes you realise that we see a kind of section of it in the UK, and that everything is laid up. It's almost like every time is there, every kind of a person. It affected me a huge amount, and it made me feel incredibly privileged, as I think it probably should. But you've obviously had that much closer contact with the people who were in most need of help and support.
Yeah, but I also feel that as volunteers we were given a lot of attention. And, you know, in some ways, I feel like we got more out of it than the kids.
Right. Right.
If I'm honest, you know, because we were going there, we were caring for them and then we'd move on. But those kids weren't moving on.
Right. Right.
You know, they'd get a little love from us and then we'd leave. And what would happen to them afterwards? Although at the time, I don't think I thought of it that way. It's only through reflection, I guess. But the other thing about that time was that there were a lot of people, the volunteers were from all over the world, so it was just a really lovely thing to meet people from all over the world.
I mean, enormous life experience.
Yeah.
And you folded all of this into a career in travel writing ultimately.
Well, I wrote this one piece, like I said, and then I did a journalism course, and from that grew the travel writing,
which has, you know, taken you to the present day in lots of ways. There's lots of lineage between what you do now and then. What I'd love to talk about now is how, because Wonderland is about finding a kind of sense of the spiritual and of magic in the landscape. And I wondered if that connected somehow to those years when you were in drift and travelling the world and not quite finding the place where you felt at home. Is there a link there, or am I overinterpreting to think that this is almost part of your search for identity and belonging?
So I genuinely was searching for magic in the landscape. I've always been interested in magic and mysticism. There are healers in my family and my mother's side, so that's always been there. I was also trying to find my voice.
But
I wouldn't necessarily link it to those years.
I was overinterpreting, sorry. I wondered if there was a kind of connection. But so let's talk a little bit about the about the most recent book. I'm really interested in your finding spirituality in the British landscape in particular, because I think it's become quite invisible in the everyday, the sort of spiritual significance of loads of different places. Would that be fair to say?
I think there's a spiritual dimension to everything if we want to see the world in that light. I don't think it's necessarily about a specific place. I think the spiritual is just another dimension, and it's all around us.
Kind of a layer that you can access.
Yes, yes. It's like twiddling the dial and finding yourself on that station.
And the reason I was really attracted to your book in the first place is that I think my impression is that quite often we play down that aspect of life, particularly in nature writing, actually. I think there's a big kind of emphasis on science and rationality. And I was just overjoyed to see you thinking about landscape and nature in a very different way, in this, you know, way that was looking for the mystical and for the kind of depth of experience.
As I said, I'd been a travel writer, and I'd had opportunities to meet people from Indigenous cultures. And in those encounters, I was always struck by the way that for these people, it was perfectly natural to enter into this reciprocal relationship with the forces of nature.
Right.
This deep communion in which it was perfectly possible to have a conversation and to experience a receiving of insight and wisdom. So while UK nature writing has tended to be very, you know, as you say, scientific and rational, in the wider world, among Indigenous people, there's nothing unusual about it.
That global perspective again really helps.
Yes.
You.
Yes. Yeah. And I know lots of people here too who write about nature in this way. They're just not called nature writers.
Right. Yeah. It's very interesting that we shut down those categories, because I think loads of people get the spiritual from their time in nature. So what would your advice be for people now if they were going through a similar phase to that phase in your life when everything seemed inaccessible and impossible? What do you draw from that time, and what would you say to people now who are going through a similar thing?
That life is cyclical.
That
there will come a point when things will shift.
Sometimes it's about patience, isn't it?
It's about patience and having faith and trusting and just bearing down, I guess, and just being with it. And it's incredibly difficult. I always say to somebody, you know, if somebody is talking to me and telling me about this really difficult period they're going through in their lives, you know, I really empathize, and I'll say, I promise you it will change. But, you know, obviously it's not the same for everybody.
No. And I find it, I mean, obviously my book was very much about that and about the life cycles and about acknowledging the cyclical nature of suffering and of periods of endurance. And I think our tendency so often now is to try and cheer people up when they're in despair, and to find that immediate thing that will fix them almost or make everything better. And I think we've got to stop believing in those quick fixes and learn about the slow fixes that they're not fun periods of your life. They're not times that you're going to feel great all the time, but they are a crucial part of remaking yourself when something bad has happened.
I agree. There are no quick fixes when you're going through a difficult time. Believe me, I tried them all.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There's no shortcuts.
There are no shortcuts. And I think what I found really hard at the time was the fear that somebody might think, well, she's not really trying very hard.
Right.
To get out of it or to make things better. And oh my God, I was trying everything.
Trying so hard, yeah. Yeah, it's often the way. And as soon as you stop trying so hard, often that's when things drop into place, weirdly.
Or when, you know, for me, I kind of resigned myself to the idea that the best years of my life had happened already, and this is how it was going to be from now on. So I better just accept it. And I kind of, when I resigned myself to this and I'd hit rock bottom, I guess, that's when things started to improve.
That's so interesting. And that great enduring myth that your 20s are the peak of your entire adult existence. I was so glad to leave them behind. I remember feeling very anxious, you know, on my sort of eve of my 30th birthday and thinking old age was going to hit me. But actually, there was something about not being young anymore that made everything a bit easier. And then hitting 40 made it easier again. And I am kind of looking forward to 50 now.
Well, yeah, I have to say I loved my 20s, but my 30s were difficult.
Yeah. I think everyone's 30s are quite difficult, actually. I can't think of anybody who didn't have challenges in them. But yeah, I think I like them better than my 20s. I felt a little bit more like I knew who I was by then. I just didn't know who the hell I was in my 20s,
right.
And certainly not in my teens. Okay, one final question, because I can't resist asking. Where's your favourite place to retreat to when you're in need of that natural solace?
Okay, so I'd love to be by the coast right now. I love being by the coast, bits of the coast where there's nobody else
what
around.
What bits of coast are your favourites?
I quite like the North Shore and the beaches on Holy Island.
Oh, it's beautiful up there.
A lot of people don't go to that side of the island. They tend to stick to the south side of the island, the day trippers. So I think I quite like that because I've stayed a few times, and when I wake up in the morning before the causeway opens, I pretty much have this coastal walk to myself. And
that's heaven.
And I'm thinking of Iona. I like Iona. Very peaceful. But really any bit of coast will do where there are no people.
Yeah.
No people. And I like my bed.
Don't we all?
It's a bed good place in a book. To
retreat. Yeah, that's nice. And maybe a cup of tea.
A cup of tea. And do you know, I've never said this before, but I am a big fan of ASMR.
Ah, are you?
Yes.
What are your favorite bits? I like the I like watching the people with the hairbrushes.
I got see, you know what I'm talking about.
I do. No, I totally know. Do you want to explain what it is for anyone who hasn't come across the joys of ASMR?
Autonomic sensory meridian response.
Oh, that's really good. I couldn't have remembered. I'm really glad you did. I'd have had to have looked it up and done like a little disclaimer at the end.
Or I think brain orgasms, as some people call them.
And some people call it brain tingles as well.
Brain tingles. Basically that nice soothing feeling you get when you watch somebody making pottery or painting or just doing nice, for me, nice healing rituals does it.
Right.
I found that really soothing.
Do you watch on YouTube, or is that something you'd do in person?
I didn't know you could do it in person.
I assume you can somewhere. I mean, I wouldn't know where, but it must happen, right?
Tell me. YouTube.
I'm more your basic, you know, ASMR geek. I just love that kind of watching people run their hands over velvet and flip sequins over and the tines of a comb going ding, 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 ding. It's often about very little delicate things, isn't it? Sound.
Yeah, deliberate, delicate motions.
And the way that some people use their hands is just so intensely beautiful. Some people just have got very elegant ways with handling objects, and that can be enough for me. That can give me huge pleasure.
Yes, the way objects are picked up and placed down.
Yes. Yeah. It sounds ridiculous to voice it, but there is,
I know,
absolute pleasure in watching it. Wow, that is such a lovely example of a place you can retreat, though. I wouldn't have ever thought of that. That's just wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been amazing to talk to you. And congratulations on your Wainwright long listing. We're in there together, but you are the first person of colour on their list, aren't you? So that's a huge achievement. Well done.
Well, thank you for having me. And congratulations on your long listing, Catherine.
I'd love to say I'm the first autistic person on the list, but I'm sharing it with somebody else. So, you know, honestly, we're like buses.
Well, it certainly is more diverse this year.
Yeah. And it needs to be. I sometimes really cringe a bit when people call me a nature writer, because I worry about the intense whiteness and middle classness of nature writing. I'm working class. I mean, I'm probably not anymore. I don't think you can be a writer and really call yourself working class. But I can get very uncomfortable and resistant about that label. And the answer to that is to open it up, right? It's not for me to not write about nature. It's for the whole genre to open up to loads of different people.
And different voices and different perspectives, yes.
Makes it so much more interesting. Well, thank you so much. I will put all of your links in the show notes and a link to your lovely book, Wonderland, A Search for Magic in the Landscape. And I'm sure everyone will want to check you out.
Thank you very much, Catherine.
Thanks, Ginny. And that's all for this week. Huge thanks to my guest, Ginny Reddy. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please do tell your friends, like, subscribe, give it some stars, whatever it is you can do on your particular platform. It really helps to get us off the ground. I'll be back next week to meet another writer who's wintered.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.